you are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible, and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
The Sermon on the Mount, Matthew, is from 5 to 7. We're beginning in chapter 8 today. 8 and 9 form a literary unit, at least through 9:34 or so. It's 10 different miracles that show the power and authority of Jesus over disease and the demonic and nature. And, boy, it's just a marvelous flow of the power of the person of Jesus. He's going to come down from the mountain, which in Matthew, remember, it's the Sermon on the Mount. In Luke, it's a Sermon on the Plain. Matthew is going to have him come down from the mountain where he taught. And now he's going to demonstrate to those who heard his tremendous words of ethics, demonstrate his power in the lives of people. What about the miraculous? Well, I certainly believe in a supernatural God. I realize that there are two primary purposes of Jesus' actions in the area of miracles. Number one was to confirm the message. Number two was his great compassion for people. And I guess number three would be, it's a sign of how it's one day going to be when we're with him. And those are the three things. You say, well, they still happen today. I certainly believe they do. I'm not able to control them. My spiritual gifts are not in the area of power miracles, and yet I do not want to disregard them just because I can't control them or explain them. So let's begin in Matthew chapter 8. When he came down from the mountain, the great crowds followed him, and a leper came up to him. Now the word leper comes from the word scales. We call a butterfly a lepidopterus, I think, which means scaled wings. And that's part of the disease where the skin scales. Now, leprosy in the Old Testament and in Jesus' day covered many skin diseases far wider in scope than our modern-day leprosy. And if you look at Leviticus 13, there's a great description of leprosy in houses, leprosy in clothes, leprosy in people. And then in Leviticus 14 is a ceremonial purification for dealing with leprosy. Now, lepers in that day had to leave their hair unbound, or, you know, it was kind of flowing. They had to cover their upper lip with some kind of handkerchief, and they had to cry unclean. Now, people were afraid of lepers. They were socially ostracized. They were afraid they would catch it. It was almost like a divine disease. It was like God's mad at you, and he zaps you with leprosy. He did that to Miriam one time, and, of course, It was just a fear people had. So this leper came up to Jesus so close, violated the social standards of his day, that Jesus touched this leper was unheard of by the rabbis of his day, made him ceremonially unclean. Leprosy fled at the touch of the hand of Jesus. Notice it mentions here, he prostrated himself before him and said, now my translation has Lord. You may have a translation that says Sir. It's the word kurios, normal Greek word for Lord, but it's used in several ways. It can be used in the sense of Mister. It's only when it's used in the full theological context of New Testament authors on the lips of those who understand Jesus is fully God and fully man that it means Lord in the Old Testament sense of Adonai, which was substituted for Yahweh. Now here, I'm not sure. He says, if you choose to, it's a third-class conditional sentence, which is hopeful potential action. He's not certain he'll do it. He believes he can if he wants to. So he's not doubting Jesus' power. He's doubting Jesus' want to. And Jesus says, I do want to. And he touched him. He was healed. Then Jesus said to him, see that you tell nobody. Now, what's that all about? Well, there's been much discussion about that. This is a common phrase in the Gospel of Mark. It's known as the Messianic Secret of Mark. I really think that Jesus, although his great compassion and confirming of the signs, miracles were a regular part of who he was, I do not think he wanted to be known simply as a miracle worker. He did not want his fame to spread simply on the basis of curing leprosy. There was a gospel to be proclaimed. There was a death by crucifixion to be gone through. Those are the major pillars of the gospel. And so it's like it's not finished yet. Don't go telling everybody. They'll all mob me and then I can't teach. Of course, you know the leper did it just that tell. Now, but show yourself to the priest and to testify to them. Now, here's the possibilities here. Number one, he wanted to show the priest that he was knowledgeable and subservient to the Mosaic legislation. Second, I think he wanted to witness to the priest that he had the power to cure leprosy, which was incurable in that day. Now, so I think you see those two things. Now, notice in verse 5, here's the second miracle. When he got back to Capernaum, that was his headquarters on the Sea of Galilee. Nazareth had rejected him because he was a hometown boy. So he moved to Capernaum. Peter and Andrew had a house there, and it became his headquarters. A Roman military captain. Now, you don't get any more outcast people than a Jewish leper and a Roman military invader to show Jesus' love for people. Boy, you talk about two wild extremes. Those who are socially outcast and those who are racially outcast. Jesus ministers to both. This was a centurion, which means leaders of 100. In our day, he'd be a sergeant major. He was a non-commissioned officer, but very trusted and a command-level officer. Now, the parallel of this is Luke 7, 1 through 10. But I want to tell you there is great, great differences. In Luke 7, this man sends a deputation of synagogue elders. They are so different that you wonder how they can be the same account and still both of them be true. Well, I want to say to you the synoptic problem is no small problem in understanding the Bible. The gospel writers apparently use some material of Jesus in unique ways. At different times and based on their own criteria. I'm not always sure what to do with these things. It's simply to say that for me, the fact they are different is a note of genuineness and authenticity. It's like eyewitness accounts to the same event, or it's like the writing of two different stories about the same occurrence, but with two different purposes in mind. And I think with that in mind, whether he came by himself or sent to is not the big issue, but that the story is genuine and the details are fuzzy, we just have to admit. Now, it was his servant boy. So the man, we learned from Luke, had a great compassion for Jews, but he was kind of a kind-hearted man. He loved this servant boy. He was willing to step out in a socially embarrassing situation to try to get this boy some help. It shows the kind of man he was. Now, the boy had paralysis. He was suffering. What he had, we don't know. And Jesus said, I will come and cure him. Now, the I here is extremely emphatic in verse 7. I myself will come. Now, of course, Jesus and the centurion knew what problems that would cause Jesus for a Jewish rabbi to enter a Gentile house. And so the man, because he was used to authority, said, oh, no, sir, no. I'm not asking you to come. You speak the word and my servant will be cured. Well, Jesus marveled at that kind of faith. That didn't demand his physical presence in some kind of ritual, magical formula or whatever. And Jesus speaks about that when he says, I haven't found this greater faith in all of Israel. And then he concludes with verse 11, so important, he says, and I tell you, many will come from the east and from the west and take their seats at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. This is an obvious inclusion of the Gentiles. He helped this Gentile, and he says this Gentile's faith greater than any he had found in the people of God, and that days are going to come when foreigners will be a part of the Messianic banquet, and Jews will be excluded. Oh, what a radical statement in this context. Now, the Messianic banquet, first of all, the Jews thought they were going to be there because they're related to Abraham. You might want to see chapter 3, verse 9, where they say, well, we're Abraham's seed. Of course we're right with God. Well, they weren't right with God because God has always, his covenant has always involved grace on his part, but demands a faith response on man's part. So national salvation has never been a reality, although God worked for the national people. Now, this deal about a fellowship meal or a messianic banquet goes back, I think, to the peace offering where a man would bring his offering, the priest would offer some of it on the altar, they would keep some of the meat, and the rest of the meat was given back to the man who brought it for a fellowship meal with his friends and symbolically with God. I think the same idea is in the Lord's Supper. The same idea is here with the fellowship that's going to be that day with all the people of God, with God. Now, notice where it says then in verse 12. Not only is the positive true that Gentiles will be there, but the negative is true, some Jews won't. While the heirs of the kingdom will be turned out into the darkness outside, where they will be weeping and grinding their teeth. Now, this darkness outside is a metaphor of spiritual exclusion, or hell, if you please. You might want to see Matthew 23:13, 25:30. And here's an obvious reference. Those Jews who do not know Jesus personally, no matter what their racial lineage, will be excluded from the kingdom of God. Now, I'm going to tell you, those of us in the church need to hear that. Just because your church is on names on some church roll, just because you do religious things, just because you're a moral person, does not mean you're right with God. Being right with God involves the personal mediatorship of Jesus Christ, our acceptance of His work, and our yielding ourselves by faith and repentance to His will for our lives. And nothing else will get us in the Messianic banquet. Now, then Jesus said to the captain, "Go, it must be done for you as you have believed." And the servant boy was cured that very hour. Boy, long distance healing. Then he went to Peter's house and saw his mother-in-law. Well, that has always been interesting to me. I guess there's a little Protestant in me still that kind of likes to scream around. Peter having a mother-in-law ought to say something about the normalcy of marriage. Matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians 9:5, Paul says Peter carries his wife around everywhere with him. So she was a regular part of his ministry. Now, notice where it mentions here, she was sick with a fever. What kind, we don't know. Jesus touched her, the fever left, and she waited on him. When evening had come. Now, from Mark 1:32, we learn it was the Sabbath was over, and people were bringing their sick. Now, they were still influenced by the religious leaders who said you can't get somebody healed on the Sabbath. So they waited till evening. Remember that Jewish days began at twilight because of Genesis 1, that evening and morning was the first day. So the Sabbath begins on Friday night, and that's the idea here. So the Sabbath was over. It was Saturday, 6 p.m. And they brought to him many who were under the power of demons, and at a mere word he drove out the spirits and cured all who were sick. Notice the distinction between the demonized and the diseased. Now, I want to tell you, many times the demons caused the diseases, but many times the diseases were there by natural occurrence. I want to say two things here. Number one, I believe in a supernatural God. I believe in a supernatural force of evil, and I believe he has part of the fallen angels that serve him that we know as demons. I'm not exactly sure of their relationship with believers. It is obvious they can possess unbelievers. I've done a tape on that, the demons and Christians. If you'd like to send for our catalog, I'll send it to you. There's been a lot of discussion in our day about it. A lot of it goes beyond the biblical bounds. We want to affirm the presence of demons. We want to affirm the presence of problems, the supernatural realm as far as temptation. And we want to affirm that Jesus has the answer to those problems. Okay? Now, notice where it mentioned those who cured. He cured all of them. Now, Matthew is going to quote Isaiah 53:4. This is the basis for the mostly modern theory that physical healing is in the atonement. Now, I must admit to you that Matthew quotes Isaiah 53 to seeming to affirm that. But he is not dealing with that theological issue that we struggle some in our day. He's just saying that this shows that Jesus dealt with the problems of men in himself. It doesn't say he bore our sickness. It's not like that he cast a demon out and the demon came into him. It's not any of that. Or he cured leprosy and he got leprosy. It's not any of that. And I think we must realize that when we look at Isaiah 53 as a whole, it's talking about our deliverance from evil and our coming in the domain of light. And I'm not sure theologically, based on this one passage, that I can affirm that physical healing of every disease, every time, is inherent in Jesus' substitutionary vicarious death. Now, I believe in healing, and I believe God still does it. But I'm not sure you can just say, well, you promised to do it for everybody anytime, and now you've got to do it. No, I don't think God's a puppet that we pull his string. Now, notice what it says, and Jesus saw the crowd about him. He gave orders to cross to the other side. Now, a scribe came up. There's going to be two scribes that come. One is going to say, oh, I'll go anywhere with you. And one's going to say, oh, I don't want to go. Now, Luke has these in a different place. And we're not sure Matthew is chronological or if he just, for his own purposes, is putting themes together. Matter of fact, we don't know a lot about which one of the Gospels is chronological and which is are thematic. We believe they're true happenings, occurrences. We believe they're inspired. And that seems to be enough for me. Now, scribe would be a term for an expert in the oral and written laws, someone to interpret to the common man what the daily affairs of life was God's will. And he came and said, teacher, rabbi, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, now, wait a minute, fella, I want you to count the cost. I want you to realize who I am. You may have a superficial idea of me. You may just think I'm a great healer or I'm just going to be teaching. But I'm going to a cross, and there's suffering involved in following me. This is much like Matthew chapter 10, take up your cross and follow me. He's saying, fellow, wait a minute. Won't you realize what you're getting into now? And he mentions foxes and birds. And then he mentions this very famous title, self-chosen title, used over 90 times in the Gospels, the Son of Man. Now, the Son of Man is used in the book of Ezekiel and Psalms quite often simply to be an Aramaic way of saying human being, person. But in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, one like unto a Son of Man comes before the Ancient of Days, riding on the clouds of heaven to receive the eternal kingdom. I think Jesus chose this title because it had no rabbinical usage, and it also affirmed the two aspects of his life that are going to be such pillars in the theology about him. Number one, he is really human. And number two, he's really divine. You see, the transportation of deity was the clouds of heaven, and that's what the Son of Man rode in Daniel chapter 7. He was really a man, but he rode in the clouds of heaven. And so from 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, we know the major theological emphasis about Jesus is he's fully God and fully man. Now, Lord, let me go first bury my father. That was an expected duty of a son, but Jesus says, my kingdom is greater priority than any earthly priorities. And I think you see that. There is a radicalness about the call of God that supersedes every other call. Do you hear me? Think about it in your life. Now, he got into the boat, went to the other side, and this furious storm came up. As you know, the Sea of Galilee is several hundred feet below sea level, and Mount Hermon overshadows it. Those winds whirl down those mountain valleys, and boy, it can whip that sea up to several feet of waves very quickly. They were in a smaller boat, held, 13 of them, and it started sinking, and they got afraid. Now, they'd seen all his miracles. They'd seen how he healed the leper. They'd seen what he did with healing by long distance and all that. They knew he was somebody unusual and special. But they still let that fear grip their hearts. I think all of us get in those places. Now, Jesus woke up and said, oh, you of little faith. Notice they said, Lord, save us in verse 25. This is the use of the word sozo or save as in physical deliverance, which is the Old Testament usage. And he calls them men of little faith, but he just speaks to the storms, and man, they're calm. The wind and the waves obey him. They say, who is this? Well, based on Psalms 89:8-9, it's deity. That's exactly what it's meant to convey. He is deity. Jesus had power even over inanimate objects, much less demons, men, and diseases. Wow, what a passage. But this has been allegorized or spiritualized as a text to say all the problems of life Jesus will... Friends, we need to be very careful with the Bible, and we need to make sure that Jesus meant to convey what we're saying. Biblical authority only comes when we understand what the author was saying to the people of his day. And I'm not sure we can allegorize this. Although I believe it's true that Jesus helps us in our problems, I don't think we can use this passage to say it. This passage wasn't meant to teach that. Then in verse 28, we have the Gadara or Gadarene demoniac. Now, they reach the other side, the district mine has of Gadara. Now, we need to realize that there's been some major geographical misunderstanding about this. This is recorded in all the Gospels, and it's spelled differently. Well, it's close to the city of Gerasa, but we know that the city of Gadara owns some land close to the lake. And so it was known as the district of Gadara, though the closest city is Cursa. Now, that's where the problem has arisen. It's on the southeastern corner of the lake, okay? Gentile area. They raise hogs. Now, when he got there, notice there was two demon-possessed men. That is a characteristic of Matthew to always have two when the other synoptic Gospels have one. Matthew has two blind men on the way to Jericho. Mark and Luke have one. Two Gadarene demoniacs. Mark and Luke have one. Now you say, well, which is right? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there was one or two or why Matthew's doubling it or the other two or leaving one out. I know that it speaks of the genuineness of the gospel accounts because it's not some kind of forced copying unity. But what else it means, I honestly don't know. Now, notice it says they lived in the tombs. Now, I don't think they were demonized, but I'm not sure that because they were demonized meant they had to live in a graveyard. They were kicked out of town. They were run off from the community. That's the only place they could live. Now, the road that went by there, we learn from two other Gospels, Mark 5, 6, 2 through 6, and Luke 8, 27, that no one could even pass on that road because they would throw rocks and scream and come out there and harass them. It was really a community problem. Everybody knew these two men and skirted this area. They were such terrors that nobody could pass that way. They suddenly screamed, "What do you want with us, you Son of God? Have you come before the appointed time to torture us?" The demons recognized Jesus Christ as God's Son. James 2:19 says, "You believe that God is one, you do well. The demons also believe and shudder." That's pretty good commentary on this passage. What we have here is the obvious example of possession, and possessed by supernatural power that understands who Jesus is theologically. Now, exactly what the conversation means here, there's some great doubt. The demons say, "What have you to do with us?" Which means we don't have anything in common. "Why have you come before our time?" Well, that tells me, first of all, they knew who Jesus was, and friends, the demons know there is an appointed time. Judgment day is coming, the demons know it. And these demons weren't saying there's not. They're saying, "Why did you come early?" Now, about this disembodied state, is there a theological reason why the demons did not want to become disembodied? Is there a reason why they wanted to go in the pigs? Well, the demons weren't trying to do Jesus any favor. Obviously, the pigs' death caused the people of that area to ask Jesus to leave, not to stay and preach the gospel. So the demons were doing just what they wanted. They wanted to cut off Jesus' message. But if there's a deeper theology about disembodied states is better and they go back to the abyss when they're cast out, I must admit to you, I don't understand all that. And I don't think there's enough in the New Testament for us to be dogmatic about it. There is a supernatural force of evil, and he is served by the demons. And we need to be spiritually aware of that. Not afraid of it, spiritually aware of it, so that we can cope with it. Now, I have no great desire or curiosity in the area of demons. But as a preacher, I think I need to know what the New Testament teaches, realize that in Jesus Christ, greater is he that's in me than he that's in the world, and not be afraid, and move right on. Now, notice that the hogs, there's a large number of them, Gentile area. Jews were not even allowed to raise hogs. We're in an area where Jesus would not be known as far as his Old Testament background. I think a great opportunity was lost here for preaching the gospel. The demoniac is sent back to his own hometown to share. And so he's his first home missionary, I guess. Notice that the hogs went off a deep cliff and were drowned. Maybe that says something about the ultimate purpose of demons anyway. Because I really think the ultimate purpose of Satan and the demonic is to destroy everything he can related to God and to destroy the objects of God's love, man. And that seemed to be the basis in the New Testament of the purpose of the demonic. It's a complete antithesis to the Holy Spirit and the angels. Now, the men who fed them went off to the town and told it to all, and what occurred to the two men who were under the power of the demons. And suddenly all the town went out to meet Jesus, and as soon as they saw him, they begged him to move on and leave their neighborhood. This is one of the most tragic statements in all of Scripture. These men were more concerned about the economic loss of the hogs and the potential economic loss of someone like this in their area than they were of the redemption and the healing and the reclaiming of these two men. It's the blindness of the world that says, if it cost me, I don't want nothing to do with it. And so they sent away the greatest man that ever lived because of a herd of pigs. And in the midst of the miracle of redemption of these two men, delivered from the demonic, changed, revolutionized, they never saw it. You know, I think we think if there was just more miracles in the church that more folks would be saved. That's just not true. The parable of the rich man Lazarus tells us that miracles won't convince anybody. Matter of fact, Matthew 24:24 says, "In the last day are going to come false teachers and do signs and wonders and lead away many people." We need to be careful about the miraculous. We need to assert that God is a supernatural God that still acts in love in supernatural ways. He normally uses natural means. He even takes that which is evil and uses it in our life. But I want to tell you, I believe in a supernatural God. I can't always explain why in our day miracles aren't as pervasive as they were in the early centuries. I can't explain that. But I want to tell you this. Isn't it a tragedy that people would either look for miracles or not be impressed by them and miss Jesus Christ? Friends, knowing God is the most significant thing, the most significant thing. And yet, these folks missed it completely. Well, I'm not going to cover chapter 9 today, but I wish you'd read on through chapter 9, almost through the end, finishes out these 10 miracles that speak of the power of Jesus over all elements of the world. Inanimate, animate, conscious, demonic, whatever. Boy, isn't he something? Doesn't he shine? Don't you see his love and compassion? I don't think Jesus ever went out of his way to do one of these miracles, but when he saw human misery, he acted. He acted. And I want to tell you, the same Jesus that walked Palestine is the same Jesus that intercedes for us at the right hand of God. My brother, my sister, I want you to know God knows where you are. He's provided a means through Christ for you to ultimately be saved and to handle the problems in time through Him. Don't miss the great truths of this chapter by fighting over, do you believe this miracle or that miracle or why or how? Don't miss the who. Don't miss the who. The real issue is Jesus came their way. Some, it changed their life. Some, they just rejected the truth. And that same thing's happening today. I hope you know Him. I hope you've invited Him into your life. I hope whether He's done the changed the circumstances for you or whatever, that you know Him. Oh, He is the Prince of Peace. He is the bright and morning star, the lily of the valley, the friend of sinners. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.